Hello, guys, gals, non-binary pals, post-apocalyptic librarians, and other. Welcome to the Sci-Fi Lab. I'm your host, DJ Squared, and with me is my co-host,
Harper,
and our two guests for the month.
I'm Karen Byers.
And I'm Kate Coker.
And this week, we're talking about sort of the growing pains of fandom. It's transitioned from print to internet and sort of how legal entities have grown up around it, really. So, anything you would like to start off with? You have this page of notes.
Two pages of notes.
So many notes.
Well, there could be more. So, the internet was a giant disruption in the way that almost everything is done. And for fandom, that was no real difference. The way that fandom operates got changed as well. So, like, a very, very brief history would be we went from fanzines to early internet access, like Prodigy, those kinds of things. People started talking about shows and things that they really liked, and then there were news groups that migrated to listservs and mailing lists.
So from print mailing lists to email mailing lists.
Email mailing lists. And then LiveJournal got its start in 1999. Fanfiction.net launched in 1998, and previous to that, there were a bunch of different options that people could develop their own hosting solutions for fanfiction. Although, again, the legalities of that were very dubious at that time. So you'd get places like GeoCities or Angel Fire or Tripod were hosting solutions, or you could just host your own. And then there was a number of problems with LiveJournal. In the late aughts, and then essentially fandom has largely online moved to Tumblr at this point, but not exclusively, and to archive of our own AO3 for fanfiction storage. So that's the super, super brief version, but there's plenty to talk about in each of those stages.
Yeah. I know that also it's interesting that fanfiction sort of self-segregated into different websites. Like, you've got a lot of the major media fandoms on AO3, but if you're looking for bandom, like, if you want fanfiction for, like, One Direction or any of these K-pop bands, you go to Wattpad and things. So people sort of self-select for those, to get the best audience, I guess, mm-hmm. for those different areas.
I've never even heard of Wattpad.
It's a scary place.
I'll take your word for it.
I looked, I hid.
What? I mean, it's very... Ugh. Trying to describe Wattpad without trashing it.
It's a fiction publishing platform. And would you say that's accurate?
I mean, yeah.
Sounds good so far.
Yeah, you have to have a membership.
It is sometimes original fan fiction, sometimes fan fiction. It is not lauded for its quality.
The general age range skews at about early teens. So Wattpad is where all the 13-year-olds who are just getting started in fan fiction go. So, like, they're trying. But most people who are outside of that age range don't go there. Well, it's either the young teenagers or, like, actual authors. Like, a lot of the Humans Are Weird stories that I've been reading lately have been external links to Wattpad from Tumblr.
Hmm.
So I'm just like, who are you people? Why are you using Wattpad?
So fanzines had a very strong showing, like, all the way through the 80s and into the early 90s. But about the time the internet became affordable for most people to have in their homes is when we start to see this kind of change. And if you have the internet, why not talk about your favorite science fiction? So then you started to see news groups that would be like, let's talk about Star Trek. I mean, Star Trek, of course, was one of the earliest and still one of the most popular fandoms to talk about.
Yep.
And there's a really great book exactly on this topic. It's by Rhiannon Bury. It's called Cyberspaces of Their Own. And it's a book-length study about how X-Files fandom changed through the early internet. And she talks about the early rec group listservs. And then she kind of concludes with the fandom moving to LiveJournal. And it's just this amazing kind of like snapshot of, you know, those early 5 to 8 years in between. She has like pictures of like, you know, the discussions people had on fora and so on. And it's awesome.
So one thing that's interesting to note is that fandom was sort of creating itself on the internet at the same time all of us were starting to figure out the internet. Mm-hmm. That all of us were like, what does it do? How does it work? Should I ever shop on the internet? Or will someone steal my credit card? Which is a thing people used to wonder. Or, you know, don't tell strangers anything about you because they're all probably axe murderers with large travel budgets who will come to your house.
Like, and then... And now it's just like, you literally can't give a fake name on Facebook anymore.
Well, I mean, as an example, when I was a kid, there was a lot of messages about, like, you know, don't talk to strangers, don't get in strangers' cars.
Yeah.
Do not get in a car with a stranger.
Don't take candy.
That too. Don't take candy from a stranger who's trying to lure you into their car. Then in the early days of the internet, it was like, don't tell strangers things like where you live. Don't tell them where you are. Don't tell them where you go to school. Don't tell them any identifying information. And now we have services like Lyft and Uber where you summon a stranger on the internet by telling them where you are. So
you can get into their car.
For the entire purpose of getting into their car.
And maybe they have candy.
They might. A lot of Lyft drivers and Uber drivers actually do have snacks. So, because gotta get that 5-star rating.
So, as a complete reversal, yes. of messaging, yep. From not that long ago.
Yeah, no, I still remember, like, in school, they would be like, yeah, don't tell strangers on the internet your full name, and don't give out information, and I'm sitting here like, bro, like, most of my friends are on the internet.
Yeah, so you're touching on one of the really important parts of the way that the internet changed things. I mean, mm-hmm. fandom has always been really community-focused, and so what the internet did was let you meet people that you wouldn't meet just through, like, your fan letter round robin or your convention that you go to once a year or whatever else. It let you meet people who lived on the other side of the world and become friends with them. So in newsgroups, people could get to know each other, but with a move to listservs, that was really a chance to create a community around a specific idea, a specific show, a specific thing. There were some that were multi-fanish, but mostly they were about one thing. They were about one fandom. They were about one pairing. And these were really interesting because you had to have the ability to set up a listserv or a mailing list, and that typically meant you had to have your own server, mm-hmm. or... you had to have access to a server where somebody would let you do that, which most people just didn't have that in their houses in 1995.
So university servers?
Yeah. University servers, yes. Many, many of these listservs were based out of colleges and universities. Of course, some people did want to run their own servers, which great for them, but most people were like, that's more upkeep and maintenance and money than I really want to sink into this. And you started to get some terms that came out of this, like list mod was one. So that's the person who's moderating the list, mm-hmm. making sure that nobody's behaving badly, that if they are behaving badly, that they're removed. Sending out friendly reminders not to do anything obnoxious, like include very large ASCII art in your signature.
Yeah. Not to copy the entirety of the B-movie script.
Right, things like that. Like, if you have to send a file, don't send a big file, like, things of that nature. But that also got turned into list mom in some cases. Mm-hmm. So somebody who was not just sort of doing the moderating of this community, but also sort of taking on responsibility for it.
The mom friend.
Yeah.
The mom friend of a bunch of people from all over the world.
Exactly. And so people would sometimes post their fan fiction or just their thoughts about an episode. And then you could email someone and be like, oh, hey, I really liked your story. And then maybe they'd email you back. And then you'd get to be friends with essentially someone you wouldn't have met any other way. But this is also a good thing to point out, like, this is before DVDs.
Mm-hmm.
This is still in the era of VHS. So if you don't have those episodes because they're not available to you in any other way, you're trading tapes with people, maybe.
Yeah.
You've got to decide if you're going to give them your mailing address so they can send you VHS tapes of the episodes that you don't have because maybe that box set isn't available yet or it's not going to be available because your show is obscure and was one season long or whatever it is.
Yep.
And great, like, unsung heroes of, you know, the early net Buffy fandom, 1997 to 1999, they did not make full VHS sets of the early seasons. Those were, like, they made, like, a couple, like, individual tapes of, like, specific episodes, like Welcome to Hellmouth and whatnot. But one of the early Buffy BNF fans, Alexander, actually made these incredible transcripts of every single episode with all of the dialogue, notes about the music that was played during scenes with the lyrics and band attribution. Incredible amounts of detail that were just invaluable because that was, if you wanted to pick up on the show, you started watching season two, season three, that was the only way you could, like, pick up from what was happening. Because the show was not in syndication, it was not available for sale, it was not necessarily a thing that you could find someone with all of the tapes. You went to the transcripts made by this one guy.
I remember those days. That was indeed somebody who was
hardcore.
Legendarily adored in the fandom for giving people that kind of access.
Yeah, that's hardcore.
Yeah.
Like, to even do the background music, like, props to you, bro.
Mm-hmm.
And I love, one of the things that I actually, like, I don't know much about this era of fandom, but I do know one thing that I found interesting. You know, in modern fandom, when you're trying to do, like, a specific AU of just like a character, like, I want, say, Harry Potter, except for he's in Slytherin this time. Like, everything else is the same, except for Harry's in Slytherin. So you do Slytherin, !! Harry, and that's your tag. And that's called a bang path, because that's how, like, early internet, that's how you sent things to specific people. So if you wanted to send, like, your file to, like, I don't know, a guy named Dave, you would attach it and do !Dave. So, and that's just a random thing that I know that came out of the early internet sort of fandom.
Back when we all had to look at code.
Yes.
So the mailing lists were, I mean, the newsgroups too, but the mailing lists were really social spaces. That's when people got to know each other. You could get feedback on your work if you wanted that. You could find a beta for somebody to read over it before you sent it out. You could ask questions. You could have opinions with other people who also had opinions. This was also a way that people borrowed and loaned fanzines. So it's not like fanzine culture just stopped immediately.
I mean, fanzines are still going, obviously.
Yeah, which it still hasn't. But it's this was a way that people shared those. So it's not as though the internet came along and replaced it. Instead, it sort of facilitated.
Like, it's replaced it to, like, a large extent now. But at the beginning, it was probably still easier to just straight up mail the thing to you.
It's a curative versus transformative fandom issue. The transformative fandom is primarily online and sites, but the curative fandom is still very much print-based and still, you know, exchanging things by print with the mail.
Yeah, sort of like the comic book fandoms, where you still, like, there are websites where you can get the newest episode of, like, Batman or whatever. But comic book stores are still a thing. And, like, I know my dad still has all of his old comics from back when he was collecting comics. 14 long boxes full of these itty-bitty comics.
Are they in bags?
Yes.
Okay.
They're in bags. But, yeah. So, like, the print culture, and especially it's not going to go away, if only because there are people like my sister who just straight up refuse to by an e-reader or something. She has books and she will live and die on a mountain of books.
So because these are social spaces, like there's some expected behaviors, and some of those have moved over from, you know, face-to-face fandom or from more kind of the ways that people interacted in print. Like, don't reply to a huge email thread just to say me too is a general rule that will get you a note from the list mom. Like, don't do that. Just email that person and say me too. Nobody needs to scroll through like 15 pages of text to read two words.
Yeah. Like, it's okay on Tumblr because there are page breaks now. There are page breaks, but still.
Like, don't hit reply all if you don't have to. I mean, that's just a good rule for life.
Yeah.
But that became a thing where you had to think about it because when in the past, when you wrote a letter, you usually weren't sending it to more than one person.
Hopefully you weren't sending a letter that just said me too, but who knows?
Hopefully you were, you know, adding more to the conversation. Yeah.
If you're just saying me too, then just send a telegram.
Right. There you go. Very quick.
Fuck you. Strong letter to follow.
So one interesting thing about this is because it's run by usually one person, those people have some power in this situation. If they, say, are affiliated with the university and they leave, then they can shut down the list and that's it. Like, there is no power of appeal. The list is done. It's over. And the same thing is true if somebody was running it off their own server and they're like, you know what, I don't feel like doing this anymore. And they just stop and the whole thing disappears. So that's a little bit different. I mean, fanzines often had more than one person involved. Like, Kate had talked about the collating parties. Like, you get a bunch of people involved to do that labor.
Yeah. Yep. But on the internet, it won't go away. Unless they shut down AO3 or something like that.
Even then, people, like, there's a download button.
Yeah.
You can download your favorite fan works. Like, and that's the thing, like, when people shut down their live journals, a lot of times their fan works would be gone, except for the one person who had copied it over,
mm-hmm.
who had, you know, copy-pasted the entire fan fiction, and now that's up there.
Plus, people host on multiple sites.
Mm-hmm.
I feel like it's really hard for things to disappear off the internet, so.
I mean, like, look at all the Vine compilations.
Yeah.
Because Vine's gone. Like, it's gone, but most of the Vines are still there.
I mean, I have fan fictions that were hosted on their own website, like someone bought a website just for their fan works and I downloaded them. And so when that website disappeared in like 2005, I still have it and I can still read it.
Yeah, exactly.
So,
So yeah, no, like people are incredibly possessive of the things they like, so much so that they will just straight up download it illegally. I mean, that's piracy. If you're poor but really like a thing, there is a website.
And we've also learned so much from the early histories of the internet because, you know, in the late 90s and early 2000s, because so many websites did disappear, we did learn to make these copies to have. You know, like, I remember actually Harry Potter fandom circa 2001, you know, going back to the idea of people being afraid of the internet, Warner Brothers actually issued cease and desist letters to multiple of the big Harry Potter websites and were trying to shut them down prior to the release of the first film. They succeeded with some of them, but there came landmark court cases about protecting fan work as fan use because of that. Ditto live journals problems. When Strike Through was 2006, 2007, they deleted a ton of Harry Potter communities and profiles. And so a lot of stuff was completely lost.
Yeah, so being able to hang on to something that you want, I think you're right, especially in the sort of fluid nature of the internet. Maybe it's there, maybe it's not there. So
maybe somebody else has it somewhere.
Yeah, so you learn to download, whereas if you had it in print, you had it in print, and it was yours, and you could keep it forever.
Mm-hmm. Unless somebody, like, stole it or borrowed it and then forgot to return it.
Right. So, yeah, I mean, they're neither of them completely stable.
Yeah. But now, But now we all have cloud storage.
Right, so the cloud is now our next option.
Yep.
Although, have you guys seen, apparently, a problem with Google Docs is apparently if you share some of your fanfic, they will delete that.
I haven't Google heard Docs. That.
Bruh.
Yeah, wow. That's literally like a brand new thing, because that was a way that I'd been acting as beta for a bunch of people for ages, and now I'm afraid to do that, because that's where I keep backups for a lot of things.
Yeah, that's where I was betaing for, like, this one girl, too. But then again, she sort of dropped off the map, so.
Right. Yeah, that's interesting. I've not heard that. Which, I mean, as we go through this history of fandom on the internet, we're going to hear a lot about times that stuff just disappears.
For no particular reason.
Sometimes that for anyone a particular says. Reason. No, but sometimes
like,
not.
But the website is just like, no, there's no reason for this.
Yeah.
Cough, cough.
It just happened to disappear. We don't know. I don't know what you're talking about. Yeah, I mean, some of that has happened. So, like, here we are in the early 90s, newsgroups, listservs, and then if you wanted to put your fan fiction on the internet, you could build a website and do that yourself. There's also big rec sites during this time, so recommendations where people would list and link to fan fiction that they liked, and they could do that on their own website. But fanfiction.net launched in 1998, and that was a big kind of multi-fandom space to have a bunch of fan fiction all in one place. And it's still around today, which is not something you can say about
everything. And there's still
people everything.
Posting on it.
And there's still people posting on it. Yeah. So, multi-fandom, unmoderated, which is different from people's individual websites. They got to decide what was posted. Fanfiction.net's like, whatever it is, you can put it here.
Except for if it...
Well,
except for
actually partially moderated, though.
Yeah, it's
like, they didn't allow, you know, NC-17 rated stuff for a long time, and they did a big purge of like R rated stuff.
Yeah, so there was an NC-17 purge. Well, they started with like, just put your fan fiction here, that's cool. And then in 2002, they were like, wait, unless it's NC-17, in which case, not cool, we're just going to delete it. And then they did that again in 2012.
Yep. That's when I left fan fiction and moved along, because they were just deleting a bunch of stuff.
Yep.
Yeah.
And then there's also the ones, like, the very specific genre songfic, where you have, like, the song lyrics embedded within the fanfic. Like, I understand that that's sort of a copyright issue.
Yeah.
But at the same time, it's not a copyright issue for the work that you're specifically making a fanfic of.
Right. So, their claim in that case was that it's a problem because you didn't get clearance for the lyrics in the song. But the transformative work itself is fine.
Yeah.
And so, essentially, when people's stuff gets deleted out of nowhere, they take it personally.
Yes.
And they get very offended, and then they go do other things.
Like LiveJournal, or DreamWidth, or AO3.
Yeah, so DreamWidth was a reaction to some of the problems that LiveJournal had. So LiveJournal got started in 1999, and a bunch of folks moved over there because it was really custom-built for communities, and it allowed you to create, in fact, community kind of spaces around specific things.
Yeah, the ability to tag was huge.
Yes.
I want this pairing, and I want this rating, and, you know, this keyword, because that's what I'm in the mood for right now. Oh, look, here's, you know, 100 coffee house AUs. Awesome.
Yep.
Like, this AU, this feeling, this length, this rating, this pairing, and it just... You can get super specific. It's like AO3's tagging system, which is super specific. And also ever-growing. Like, if you get enough of a tag, it becomes an official tag. So it'll appear in the search function now. So if you want, like, specifically trans Harry Potter, that's its own official tag.
Mm-hmm. And so. It was revolutionary. Because before that, what would happen is that you'd go to a Rex page that you'd found that you liked, and then you'd read through it. And sometimes the person who liked those fan fictions would organize them, and sometimes they would not, and sometimes they would link them in a good description, and sometimes there wouldn't be, and you were just sort of like, it was much more sort of serendipitous when you found something good. It was much more like, oh, How lovely.
That's still true for rec pages now. I've had to sift through some
being able to tag gave you the option to search, which, I mean, this is where the librarian in me is like, yes, that's how you do it.
Yes, God.
Being able to organize the information based on essentially subject headings is a great way to be able to make it easier for people to find what they're looking for. It's much better information access. And people loved it. So you could have your own journal, and then you could add other journals as friends, and then you could have a degree of granularity about how much they could see. Some people only posted about fandom, and some people also wrote about like their day-to-day lives, but they didn't want that freely on the internet, so they'd lock it just so that their friends list could read it. And it allowed people more options in terms of how they wanted to interact, as well as specific communities around things. So like Harry Potter fiction communities, or let's see, what were some of the other ones?
Basically
Star
everything.
Trek. Always Star Trek.
Always Star Trek.
Yeah. I mean, this was the late 90s, so we were in the middle of the Star Wars prequels, and that was a terrible time.
Stargate,
yes, very popular.
X-Files,
hugely popular, yeah.
Buffy and Xena, man.
Yes.
Xena fandom was a great place.
So that was in 1999, and fandom pretty much was like, this is the best, and not exclusively, but largely moved over. And that's something that's also important to note is that, like, by and large, most people are going to move to the next thing, but there's always going to be some people who are like, no, I like it here.
I'm going to sit in my box. And, like, everybody else moves over to a different box. And just sort of...
But then the good content, for some reason, is gone now, and you're like, why can't I find anything good anymore? And it's because everyone else has moved on.
Yep. Either that, or like you can find plenty of good content, but you can't find new good content because everybody's moved.
Mm-hmm. Definitely.
And the same thing that we had talked about with some of this other stuff, I mean, it's still true, but if somebody deleted their journal, then like whatever they posted was gone. So if you didn't keep a copy, well,
you better hope somebody else did.
You better hope someone else did, and they're willing to send you a copy of it through email, probably at that point.
That's why I'm really grateful for AO3's orphan function.
Yeah.
Where if you don't want to be, like, associated with this one work anymore or with this one fandom, you can, instead of deleting it off of your account, you can just orphan it. So it just sort of becomes the property of the website, I guess.
Mm-hmm.
So it's still there. You just...
And that's something that developed.
It's just not yours.
In response to these kinds of situations where people were like, I gotta go, for whatever reason, and took all their stuff with them. Because it was easier, a lot of times. So LiveJournal was sold to a company called Six Apart in 2005, and another company called SUP in 2007. And the original creator left in 2007. There were two big issues with LiveJournal called Strike Through and Bold Through, respectively. So Kate made mention of this a little bit earlier, Strike Through.
You want to talk about Strike Through? Strike Through?
Okay, so Strike Through was a period when LiveJournal decided to just straightforwardly delete a ton of Harry Potter fandom, because one of the big pairings of that time was Snarry or Snape Harry. And that got tied into a lot of the ever-recurring conversation of, this is pedophilia, no it's not. And LiveJournal decided, you know what, we're just going to back away, and we're going to delete anything that is identified as Snarry or has anything related to, you know what, screw it, let's just get rid of as much Harry Potter fandom and all the R-rated stuff as we can. And so they did that. Tons of stuff lost. And in many ways, that kind of led to that first jump from LiveJournal to DreamWidth. What happened a few years later, LiveJournal learned from its lessons, but then it was sold to a company in Russia, which it remains today. And so one of the things that happened because of this, LiveJournal was used as a major blog platform for political blogs in Russia, and during the 2011-2012 elections, like, they were getting denial of service attacks. So you could go for days or weeks without even being able to access the site. So you couldn't have conversations. You couldn't read fic. You couldn't look at your bookmarks. You couldn't really access anything that you were trying to keep track of on the site. And then last January, they completed the server move over to Russia, and the terms of service agreement changed. And one of the big things about it, there's a translation someone made into English because the actual agreement was in Russia, along the side lines of, if anyone decides that this anything on your live journal could be anti-Russian or propaganda or share too much or say we don't like, we reserve the right to fully delete you. And so there's still like a handful of things on LiveJournal, but it's mostly mirror-based. Like, I keep a copy of my LiveJournal, but I also have a backup agreement. And like, the difference in where people are and what they're posting is completely different because so many people have abandoned it at this point. A lot of people opt to delete or lock their material. Like, it's kind of just buried at this point.
Yeah, so Strike Through, the name came about because when a journal was deleted, it was still visible, but it was like the name had Strike Through text. Hmm. And then there was no content, essentially, in the journal.
Like, the actual journal was blank.
Right.
But the name was like, this person has been deleted.
Yeah, yeah. So, I mean, what happened in that case is that... because so many fanish journals were affected and people were kind of feeling like this was sort of their community, you know, their sort of home on the internet. And then suddenly either your journal's been deleted without you having any knowledge about that, or like half of your friends list is gone, or, you know, that thing that you were participating in, that community, there were, you know, groups called communities in LiveJournal, disappeared, then people kind of, it made them feel unwelcome and unsafe, is essentially. That's what a lot of the conversation around that time was about. And then, not that long after, there was a different issue called Bold Through, because it did the exact same thing, but it put the title of the journal, the name of the journal, in bold instead of Strike Through. Mm. But it was essentially the same thing that happened, except more. So that made a lot of fans question about, where do I keep my materials? Where do I keep my fic where it's not going to just disappear? How do I keep in touch with my friends? How do I have conversations in a meaningful way? Like, and it prompted the move to other platforms. So Dreamwidth was in beta right about the time that this was happening, and a lot of people just moved over there completely. And it is fan-run, and there's, you know, some degree of, you know, nothing's a perfect guarantee, but some guarantee, it feels like more so to people that their stuff isn't just going to disappear mm-hmm. in the middle of the night without them ever knowing about it.
Middle of the night? No note?
No note, nothing. And this actually made the news. So Strike Through, LiveJournal support was the support community, and a bunch of people are like, where's my journal? Mm-hmm. And they did not respond to that.
Was this exclusively Harry Potter?
No, but largely.
Okay, because I read that J.K. Rowling was very against pornographic or smut Harry Potter fan fiction. Was like very vocal about how much she disliked it. So I wonder if she had any sort of role in this, if she had contacted LiveJournal.
Not that I'm aware of.
Probably not. Like, that would, like, she disapproved of the slash, but I think she knew enough to know that, actually doing anything about it would knock her off of her pedestal real quick.
Yeah, there's nothing about it on fan lore, for what it's worth.
Yeah. For a creator to be so directly involved would be unusual.
Well, not outside of the realm of possibility, though.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Anne Rice might have done it.
I did read that, and also I feel like it was Terry... his name, Terry Pratchett?
Terry Pratchett.
Pratchett, okay. I think that he also... No, maybe I'm thinking of Anne Rice. I know he was vocal against fan fiction. He said, like, he didn't want to see it, he didn't want to read it, he didn't want to trip over it, no one should put it in his way whatsoever. And That his ideas were his own, and he owned those ideas, and he didn't really like the idea of fan fiction.
Huh.
So I think I'm confusing that with Anne Rice, who was also really against it.
Very much.
But, yeah.
So, yeah.
But she actually took action against it.
Yeah, which is a whole other element of this. So back in the days of mailing lists and, like, create your own archive on a webpage, fan fiction had headers, which would include usually stuff like the title, the author's pseudonym, usually with a link to wherever they kept their stuff. It would include the word count sometimes,
mm-hmm.
The pairing, the rating, sometimes a summary. If it was part of a larger series, like if it was part two of a trilogy or something like that. And usually a disclaimer, a legal disclaimer. And originally the language on those was very legalistic. It was like, I make no claim to ownership of these characters and do not profit through using them. And if people don't even really do headers anymore, but if they do, it says something like, not mine, don't sue.
Yep.
Like, yeah. I remember
when that shifted.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Like, it's not nearly so, like, concerned with actually standing up in a court case. But as Kate pointed out, people got cease and desist
mm-hmm.
letters, and many authors were less aware of fan fiction at that time, but less welcoming too. I mean, there are authors now who are like, it's very flattering that you want to do that. I don't want to read it,
yeah.
Which, I mean,
please don't send it to me because there's legal issues involved with that.
Right.
But.
Right. Because you could end up with a fan being like, you read my fan fiction and took an idea from me.
Mm-hmm.
And then you do have a real legal case there, potentially.
That was Marion Zimmer Bradley, straight up.
I know, that happened, and that actually happened. One of Marion Zimmer Bradley's many, many problems, many, many problems, was she had a fan writing with her and essentially...
stole the ideas.
Yeah.
No
yeah.
credit.
No.
Yikes.
Well, so she attempted to. She actually lost the book contract because the publisher was like, I'm not going to touch this anymore. Do something new. Do something totally unrelated. Do not do this. So, we yeah. there is a gap in the canon because of that.
Because the publisher just noped right out of that contract.
Yeah. Decided
they
to.
They were also one of the interesting things that she did do because... she was so involved with her fan community, which they published 12 anthologies of fan writing, of, like, recognized fanfic that she edited, and these were published commercially, so you could, like, go to the store and, like, buy, like, a legit book of fanfic. And so they ended up, like, putting in the kibosh on that anthology series, like, the fanzines just died. That was really the end of that particular fandom.
Yeah, it changed the way that other authors saw things. Like, I remember Mercedes Lackey, who's a fantasy author in the 90s, had a form that you could fill out that essentially you'd mail to her and she'd mail back to you in a self-addressed stamped envelope, which was like I forget what she called it, but essentially it's a you-can-play-in-the-sandbox legal form. Where she's formally giving you permission to write fan fiction in her universe using her intellectual property. But that was an unusual solution. A lot of people were like, how could you do this? That's terrible. And other people were like, I don't really have a problem with it, but my agent says it's not a good business decision for me to endorse this, and I pay my agent for her advice, so that's what we're going to go with. Whereas now, I mean, I think, if nothing else, a lot of authors seem sort of resigned to the fact that this will happen. Some are actively
yeah.
supportive.
And some of them, like Neil Gaiman, actually, you know, they got their start in fan fiction, or they just wrote a lot of fan fiction.
E.L. James.
many people did. And some
yeah.
still do, but they won't talk about it, which
yeah.
is understandable.
I mean, reasonable.
But,
yeah.
So legal issues were a real thing, and there were times when sometimes... a website would disappear because website provider got a letter or was concerned that they might So it was indeed riskier, but it also felt riskier. You know, some 15, 20 years ago to do this.
And like the same, like we still see this happen like a lot on, specifically for fan vids on YouTube, because that's the automatic copyright like filters will go through and just take down your video or mute the audio. Mm-hmm. Or just tell you, you can't use this, stop.
Somehow, the one fan vid I ever made, probably 12 years ago, still up, still running, still has the audio, and I'm sitting here like, why? But I don't remember the password, so I can't log on, I can't take it down, so I'm just waiting for them to do it, but they won't. I'm like, I don't want this up anymore.
Meanwhile, most of my videos had copyright violation, but that's because I was using characters from this online game that I play, MapleStory. So there's an entire community around MapleStory and making videos using the character, like the sprites from the game to like do music videos or dramas or fan vids or, you know, web series. Like that's a concentrated community thing. But MapleStory, specifically MapleStory Korea, is really stringent with, like, they just throw down the ban hammer, like, whenever, like, all of the copyright infringement, like, no, you can't do this. Some of the community is still up, but it's not active anymore, just because it was just copyright infringement.
Yeah, and some authors, are more aggressive. Yeah. What?
I suggested aggressive, accepting, and you went for the opposite.
Yeah, I was going to say aggressive in defending what they feel is entirely theirs. So I was thinking of Diana Gabaldon from a few years ago. Mm-hmm. Anne Rice is kind of famous for this. But people who are completely and totally horrified and say things that end up often alienating fans. I don't recall exactly what Diana Gabaldon said, but it upset a lot of people.
She said, and someone screen capped it, but it was removed from her website. She said that to her, reading fan fiction was like someone breaking into her house, kidnapping and raping her children.
So a little over the top.
More than a little.
When she got the TV agreements to do the TV series, all of a sudden, like, she became mum on the topic because, you know, things were no longer in her control. Like, you know, Ron D. Moore did Star Trek and Battlestar and a bunch of other things. He knows that there's no stopping the internet. So all of a sudden, a lot of her anti-fan rants, you know, were deleted, you know, and she either doesn't address it or says it in carefully neutral terms at this point.
But the fandom members, the fandom screen caps all.
Yeah.
So
we do not forget. We do not forgive.
Do not forgive. Nope.
That's really true. Fans have long memories about people's behavior,
and they hold a lot of grudges.
Yes.
the grudge holding in fandom is, it's like a sport.
Yes. And that's kind of what happened with LiveJournal. I mean, like when a bunch of stuff disappeared in Strikethrough, people went to LiveJournal support, and LiveJournal support did not respond to them.
Mm.
And this got picked up by Boing Boing, which is, you know, a geeky news site, CNET, Metafilter.
Wired.
Huh?
Wired. They did a whole, like, thing about it in their print magazine. Like, it was a multi-page investigative essay.
Yeah, so this was getting, like, some mainstream attention. And about that point was when LiveJournal was like, oh, hey, yeah, about that.
Trying to backpedal.
Yeah, and it didn't go well. So that's about the time that the Organization for Transformative Works was first starting to say, hey, guys, what if we had this, essentially, and that helped solidify the idea, like, let's buy some servers and have our own place to put this stuff where nobody else can decide whether it stays up or not. And that's really where Archive of Our Own got the push to get it started and keep it running.
And its name, probably.
And its name, yeah. I mean, it's a nice nod to Virginia Woolf as well, who said that in order to write, one needs 500 pounds a year in a room of one's own. So an archive of our own, you know, is a nod in that direction, but also like, we own this, leave us alone.
Yeah. That's how I took it. Like, yeah, this is ours.
Yeah. And it runs mostly on donations. They do like a drive every year to help keep the funding up. So the in modern fandom as of today, broadly speaking, the fan fiction lives on AO3 and the social part happens on Tumblr.
Yeah. I mean, they'll crisscross occasionally. Like, I know a lot of fic either starts on Tumblr or is reposted to Tumblr. So, like, I think one of my favorite DC comic, well, actually my only DC comic fan fiction author, Kitty Unpretty, who writes a bunch of really great Batman fan fiction. There's one which is just a bunch of screenshots of spreadsheets that Bruce has made. And it's like, the tabs are why I'm reasons why I'm sad. And they're like, well, actually, no, the title of the entire file is reasons why I'm sad. And then there's like tabs for legitimate petty. It's great. But like, she got she started writing, I believe, on Tumblr. Like, she posted her, like, Batman fanfictions of, like, Tim Drake's Vine account on Tumblr, and then moved to AO3, especially when stuff got longer. So.
Mm-hmm. What I liked about AO3, I've only used fanfiction in AO3, is that I felt like other media was welcome there, too, because people had, like, book covers that they made for their fanfic, and, fan art attached to the fanfic, which I feel like on fanfiction.net, I almost never saw that.
I don't think you could do, like, you could have the book cover, like, there was a specific place for the book cover, but I'm pretty sure if you wanted to put fanfiction in it, it would have to be an external link. Whereas AO3, you can just embed it in the thing. And that's nice. And also, AO3 does allow you to post fan vids or podfics. Podfics are really popular, which is people reading the fan fiction.
Okay.
Yeah, so, we haven't talked about podfics yet.
No.
I've never listened to one.
Neither have I, but like whenever I'm looking for like a fanfiction that I really liked a while back, I'll have to like scroll through the podfic version. Because it's just, like, it is an external link to an audio file where it's just maybe one or more people just reading this fan fiction. It's an audiobook, but it's a fan fiction.
I was going to say, it might be nice for my commute where I sit in the car for 2 hours on the way home and run out of things to do. So
And I'll interject, a lot of podfics are amazing professional quality. Like, the readers, I mean, it's not any different and often is better than reading or listening to your average audiobook. A lot of them will also do, like, you know, add special effects, like, for sound or opening and closing music credit things. Podfic people are amazing, basically. You think you're going to get, like, this half-hour thing of someone reading a story, and then it is so much more.
It's basically a production.
Yeah, so
it really is.
Going back to fandom as a labor of love.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, people do put a lot of time into their fan fiction. And I love the trend of translating fan works. Because one of my favorite fan series is actually in the process of being translated into Chinese.
Yeah, which so AO3 will support other languages, which is cool. Yeah.
You have to, like, sometimes you'll have to, when you're searching for something, you'll go to the sort section and be like, all right, I only want the English ones. I cannot read Russian. I'm sorry.
I tried to read some Spanish ones sometime. Only having high school Spanish didn't work out
that
for me.
That does not sound like it would work out very well.
Well, along those lines, like, one thing I've gotten addicted to is, like, Chinese and Korean dramas, many of which are based on books, but you can almost never get the book in English. And so there are entire epic websites devoted to amateur translations of novels. And some of them are, like, almost academic. Like, they will have extensive footnotes of, you know, here's the word used. This word can mean this or this with shades of this. I opt for this to imply blah, 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 because we know later on. And, I mean, it's amazing the efforts that will go that people will put into this. And it's so important because, you know, Chinese science fiction is something that is getting more attention, and there's a handful of books that are published legally in English over here, but getting translated works is so difficult, and there's so much stuff out there.
Yeah, I love, like, any translator just online, I love you guys. You're awesome. All of the people who take the time to, one, either they, like, have grown up knowing both languages, or, like, I have met people who just love, like, manga so much that they learn Japanese specifically so that they can, like, become a translator for, like, mangareader.net and stuff, so that they can translate the manga into English so that other people can enjoy this thing that they love, too.
Mm-hmm. It's, like, super curative.
Mm-hmm.
Because you have so much, you have knowledge of it in two languages, and you want to share that knowledge of what you love so much.
Yep.
So, sort of transformative, but also very curative.
I feel like that's more curative than anything else. Because you're not really transforming the
story.
The story. You're transforming the language, but it's still like analogous.
Mm-hmm.
So yeah, all translators out there, you get a big thumbs up from DJ.
So one thing I'm curious about is what the next thing is going to be. I mean, AO3, I get the feeling, is probably going to stick around.
Mm-hmm.
But what's next? Because one thing we've learned, if we've learned anything about fandom, it's that it's going to recreate itself somewhere when something stops working. So at whatever point Tumblr actually tumbles off a cliff, like,
it'll happen.
What'll be the next thing? I mean, nothing bad about Tumblr. It's just that platforms aren't stable over long periods of time.
I know we thought it was going to be IMSI, but IMSI's gone. So.
Maybe it will surprise us all and go to MySpace.
Oh, no.
MySpace largely just was not a fandom thing.
No, that was specific. That was musicians, actually. Yeah,
yeah, it was
the
musicians.
The only people who still use MySpace are musicians.
Yeah. That's why it'd be a shock.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, you know, Bandom, but it's
maybe the next thing will be virtual reality, and we will have actual holodecks.
That's what I was thinking. My brother works in virtual reality stuff, and I was thinking, you've got this fanfic, and then they make it reality for you, and you can, it's almost like watching TV or a movie, but it's someone's fan work, and I think that'd be fantastic.
Or you're, instead of going into a chat room, you go into a literal chat room, and everyone is their avatars, like
sipping tea.
You see this person over there, and they look like a randomized sim, but you know, that's just what they decided to look like.
It'd be really cool.
Gonna go around as a randomized sim.
Yeah, so that's where things are after, you know, a history of, you know, 20-ish years. So there's plenty more to come.
The history of modern fandom. I mean, who knows where it's going next? It might take a really weird left turn.
Well, one of the things I thought was interesting a couple of years ago, FitGate, where, I don't know if you guys followed this at all, but there was a course being taught at Berkeley, and one of the assignments given was to go comment on someone's stories, and this got so much pushback because turns out BNFs don't like having their typos pointed out. Most other things. And so, one, this led to an ACA fandom, like these epic conversations about the ethics of, you know, interacting with fan texts and so on. But it also led to this conversation along the lines of fans and fan authors tend to think of their writing and reading as being private in a way that it really isn't anymore. And the idea of you want to have control of your text, you can't necessarily have it open online. And so scholar Anne Jemison, in one of these conversations, she said something like, if people really want to have control over their fan work, the only way to do that is to go back to print. And so I like this idea of, you know, book history is one of my things, the idea of limiting your audience and providing control of your text to print is absolutely fascinating.
That we might come back around full circle. So
and
that
in some ways you start to see that there's fan books mm-hmm. are a thing to see on Kickstarter now, where it's like a one-off fanzine, well printed, well bound, and so on, to have like this kind of commemorative artifact in print. That's so cool.
Yeah, like I said, print culture isn't going away anytime soon.
So there are books out there that, to me, I don't know necessarily where they fall, because, so it's like, I own Stargate novels, mm-hmm. but they were written by fans. They're not writers of the TV series. But they...
Those are sanctioned fan works.
Yeah, and they make, you know, they all make money off of it. But I did have a realization earlier that they're terrible. And the reason why they're terrible is because they can't really add much to the canon. Because not a lot of people are reading them. And so they can't be dramatic. They can't have super exciting stories that would change canon in any way. Like, your main character isn't going to die off in some random fan work for Stargate, even if it's sanctioned. So, because I was sitting here wondering, like, why were all of those so boring? And it's because they couldn't have anything that majorly affected canon.
There were no stakes, really.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Okay, so, I have to ramble. Okay, so the interesting thing about early Star Trek media tie-ins is that they were done by a lot of people who started as fan authors. And so, like, originally, Paramount had no investment in making all of the novels kind of share a universe. So they're all, like, all of these one-off stories, and they are often incredible. Like, there is a duology by, I'm blanking on the names, but there are two novels that are legit about Spock's son that was conceived during the episode Back to Tomorrow, I think. And so they do a lot of creative things. But then as time has gone on, they've started pushing licensed tie-ins to kind of like in-house stable writers who don't always even know the canon that well. So I recently bought the most recent Star Trek Discovery novel, Drastic Measures, which is about young Gabriel Lorca and young Philippa Georgiou during the Tarsus IV disaster. And it's terrible. Because, one, it came out after Discovery was concluded, and so whoever was writing was not told that the Gabriel Lorca that we saw on screen, spoiler, is from the Mirror Universe. So he's consistently written as this asshole, even though it's a Prime Universe Lorca. And, two, they're talking about the Tarsus IV disaster, which is referenced in the original series episode, Conference of the King. Which, when it's referenced there, it's explicitly couched in Holocaust language, because it's about genocide, but none of that is in the book. Like, they never use the word genocide. They try to, like, awkwardly work in a refugee crisis, kind of seem contemporary and relevant, but it uses all of this loaded language that was very much the norm from the 1960s. It's a fascinating hot mess of a book. All because the person does not know fan the original text as well as, you know, a fan.
And you see that sometimes with just, like, authors of the actual TV show. Like, they'll bring someone in a few seasons later, and they just haven't seen the show, or at least, or they don't remember it that well. And suddenly you get all of these character mismatches, and all of the fans are screaming, "Why are you doing this? Why are they doing this?
Is this...
this is wrong."
Like what you were talking about a few weeks ago, about Supernatural.
Yes.
This season where it's all about... which one? Sam?
Sam. No, that was overall the writers did not understand yet that Sam was not actually the main character of the series. That it's Dean.
Also, I thought that you were going to talk about, they kind of retconned recently calling Castiel Cass instead of Kaz, and they got into enough arguments about this with the fans that they actually gratuitously put in, like, a little scene of, like, Dean's phone showing that Cass, C-A-S-S, was calling.
That's wrong. That's wrong. I'm sorry.
It's wrong.
No, I actually haven't watched past, like, halfway through season 9 because I couldn't do it anymore. But, yeah, no, I've heard a bit about the Cass versus Kaz thing, and 2 S's is wrong. I am part of the fandom majority, and there's just 1 S. I mean, his name isn't Cass, double S-T-L. It's just C-A-S-T-I-N. Anyway.
Example.
Yeah.
So yeah, I mean, authorized novels do sort of tread the line between fan fiction and the canon, so to speak. I mean, officially they're canonical. But as we've seen with Star Wars, the owner of that property may decide to be like, actually, they're not. I mean, for a long time in Star Wars fandom, we just had the original trilogy, and then we had books. And the books were of varying quality, but there were a lot of them. And they were the expanded universe. And then recently, with the newest trilogy of movies coming out, I'm trying to think who owned Star Wars at that point. I think it was Disney. We're like, actually, no, none of those are canon anymore.
Yeah. When Disney bought the property, they were like, yeah, no.
Right, because in those books, Han and Leia have twins, for starters, a boy and a girl, which wasn't really going to work out with the entire plot of The Last Jedi. Luke has
a former assassin wife.
Yeah, Luke has a former assassin wife. Her name is Mara Jade. She's actually really awesome. And he isn't a sad monk on a rock. So, yeah, I mean, they really had to say none of this counts because it would not work with the canon that they're establishing.
Well, these Stargate novels, they don't change the canon at all. It's really like a standalone episode and usually...
kind of a boring episode.
Very boring. But I like dramatic things, so...
a filler episode.
Yeah.
So it was a book of a filler episode.
Yes.
That's gross.
It's awful. And the writing itself is lacking, usually, like the grammar and everything. Oof. And I'm just sitting there like, why can't these be better?
See, at the very least, that's one of the things I like about anime, is that at the very least, anime filler episodes are fun. They're silly and they're fun. And they don't add much to this. Sometimes they do add something to the story. But at least you're going to have a good time. Most of the time. Unless you get 100 straight episodes of filler, and then that's what we call Naruto. Yeah, and I think my minor rag on Naruto is where we're going to leave this today. So, thanks for listening.